Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Steve Zandin for Jane Lindholm. Children's books are full of fantasy and wonder, but we don't often think of them as being full of science. Two professors at St. Michael's College have teamed up to write a book about the biology in children's literature. It's called Books in Bloom, and Jane Lindholm sat down with the authors recently to talk about their unique collaboration. It all started when education professor Valerie Bangenson invited biology professor Mark Lupkowitz to her graduate-level class for elementary teachers.
So I got this book called Winter Barn by Peter Parnell, and it's a picture book. And it's very similar to our experience here in Vermont, where the snow falls, everything's cold. I read it aloud. And then I asked them what they heard and what they saw, and they talked about the spare drawings and the poetic sense of what was going on. And then and they talked about the seasonal rhythm. And I said, so, Mark, what did you see?
And I thought it was a horror story because there's an owl, a snake, and a mouse, and they're living together in a barn in the wintertime. So two are food groups and one is a predator, right? And as you might predict, I was the only one in the room that saw it that way. And it's just a function of how I've been trained, or partially the way I've been trained as a biologist, is that when you introduce the cast of characters, I saw a food chain.
So in this book, are you trying to get people to look at books from any different angle and find different ways to pull apart lessons?
So our tagline for our courses, and we even wear little buttons that say this, is embrace complexity. And so one of the things that we want our audience to get, as well as our students, is that the world is a really complicated place. And it's not really about black and white, but a lot of gray space. And so this book is really exploring the gray space at the intersection of children's literature and gardening.
And I think that what we want to show is how those two perspectives enhance, each enhances the other. And so we chose books that couldn't work without strong literary elements and strong biology. And we often ask people where they learned that poppies have a soporific effect. Where did you learn that poppies put you to sleep? And they usually say, The Wizard of Oz. And Mark likes to say that the poppies are a literary device, and that's the case for many of the roles that plants play in the book that we chose. You can't separate them.
Well, let's talk about one book in particular, and of course, a children's favorite for so many generations, one of my favorites, and one I think that a lot of listeners will know, Blueberries for Sal. It's obvious in the title, we're talking about blueberries, but why do you think we should read that with an eye towards the botany?
It's interesting. That, I think, is about foraging at some level. And so there's two foragers in the story, right? So first there's the bear and the cub that are foraging for the winter. And then there's Sal and her mother who are also foraging for the winter. And so I drew parallels between how we still have we still very much have animal-like behaviors. And that, you know, the bears forage and we forage. And then another thing that we explored was how do you recognize your offspring?
And I think it wouldn't be that interesting if it just said bears do this and people do this. But instead, it plays on that old separation of mother and child and reunion at the end. So the fictional element supports what we learn about biology.
And this book is really geared towards teachers or people who are putting together lesson plans for children, more so than just the casual reader or casual parent.
It's for people who want to like to read to their children and like plants. So I think librarians, teachers is clearly the target audience, as well as homeschool.
Grandparents who love to garden.
So from Blueberries for Sal, what kind of lesson plan or other activities would you come up with?
Well, one of the things that I like to point people to is just the aesthetics of the book. And it's not as noticeable to children today because they're so used to brilliant color. But it's done in blueberry blue ink, which is really appealing and supports the whole topic that it's about. So I would want to point that out. And also we invite them to make their own blueberry jam and to look at things that are safe to forage.
Yeah, I liked exploring the idea of what why are some berries edible and others are not? And why are some blueberries, those that are actually blue, edible, and some blueberries are and some are not? And we talked about this a little before on the mic, but I'm interested in plant chemistry. And so plants make a whole slew of compounds that we call secondary metabolites that are some are very beneficial, which we'd call antioxidants, and some are really not. which we'd call toxins, right?
Right. So, I mean, there is that sense of you, if you're foraging, you have to know what you're foraging
right.
for. One of the other books that you explore is A Fruit is a Suitcase for Seeds. And I wasn't great. Familiar with that book, but I loved the descriptions of it and how you can teach people about what is a fruit and what isn't a fruit and what people commonly misidentify as a vegetable or a fruit.
I think fruit is one of the most misunderstood words in the English language as far as a plant person is concerned. And I blame the grocery association for this, if I may. But fruit is anything that encases a seed, right? And it evolved as a way to disperse seeds. And so a dandelion, that thing that we blow on, that little wispy piece is actually a fruit. Most of us don't see it that way, but it actually is, right? And so a tomato is not a vegetable. It's actually a fruit. A cucumber is a fruit. A watermelon is a fruit. An orange is a fruit. Anything that has a seed inside of it is a fruit. And it evolves so it can move that seed from point A to point B. Now, what's interesting is because plants are not modal, like they can't move from point A to point B, they have to use something else, right? So what can you use? You can use animals who either carry you or eat you and then poop you out somewhere else, or you can use the wind or water.
And Valerie, why is this worth reading from the literature perspective?
Well, you love the title, right? It's a great metaphor. And I think that what it offers readers is a way to consider how language can best express an idea. And it also has wonderful illustrations that are very cartoonish along the bottom in an almost postmodern way where they're interpreting what's happening, adding a little bit of humor. At one point, there are cherries that one child uses as earrings. So it's another kind of metaphor, visual and linguistic.
You also really liked the visual metaphors in the book Grandpa Green, where they use topiaries to convey points in time of this grandfather's life as his mind is disintegrating.
We did. We looked at it for a long time to consider whether to use it because it's won a lot of awards, but we wondered what was the angle that would appeal to children. And I think that children are really good at using all kinds of natural objects to create a visual image or a picture. And Lane Smith, who's the author and illustrator of this, did a brilliant job of this, using all kinds of greens and representing things that are representational in a really unique way.
The biology was a little tough in that one because the topiary it's not accurate. You know, you can't take most plants and make it into a tank
right.
And the flowers don't come out looking like a parachute or whatever. So, but I could work with that.
Yeah. So how do you do that? I mean, then do you feel like you're sort of manhandling the book into the...
No, I was very clear about, there was some liberties taken by the author, and that's fine. And there are plants that can be shaped. And so what makes one plant shapeable and another plant not shapeable? And so these are the characteristics that makes you eligible for topiary.
Well, and then one of the things that you advise people that they could do as an activity is to create a moss...
Oh, yeah. This is great.
...creature. I had never heard this before. I kind of want to go home and do it, but you mix up moss and buttermilk and other things, and then you can spray it onto a frame and it will actually grow moss?
Yeah, so moss, it turns out, if you shred up moss, each of the individual cells can actually grow into the whole organism. And so if you put it into a blender, just a clump of moss and then some sort of original nutrients, so buttermilk works great, and then thin it down so you can actually spray it or paint it, and over time it'll become a moss sculpture. And so that's much easier than trying to make topiary out of your favorite peach tree or whatever.
And how long will it last, the moss sculpture, if you keep watering
it? As long as you water it and probably don't put it in the south side in the full sun, it'll probably be okay.
So we wanted to invite readers to create their own personal icons, just like the author does in the book for the grandfather, using the moss paint.
A lot of the books that you've chosen to review or talk about have a very clear attachment to botany or to the natural world. Are there other books that don't quite fit in the framework that you established for this book, but that you think are also worth looking at in that way? I mean, you mentioned The Wizard of Oz as a place where a lot of people learn about poppies. Are there other places that you point to in literature or children's literature that you think have this sort of tangential attachment that people don't even realize they're getting?
as it turns out, that our next book, or we think is going to be our next book, is The Next Generation Science Standards, has 7 key principles that should be K through 12. And so we actually want to write a similar book, but actually looking beyond plants at all science standards. So yes, there's science is ubiquitous, right? I mean, we live in the physical world. It's a physical world. You can't escape science.
Right, so life cycle is a very common theme in children's books, and whether it's plant or a pet or an aging grandparent. So I think that we're actually eager to find books at all the different age levels that would support or illuminate these seven themes that are in the new standards for science.
Are there other books, Mark, when you read them, you immediately pick apart the science of when the rest of us are thinking, oh, that's such a beautiful story about these animals that all get along together in this winter barn?
Yeah. I mean, it's hard for me not to do that. I am a real person, so I like to enjoy, I read a lot of science fiction and fantasy, and I can let it go. But there are times, especially with my own children, where I say, that's not quite, it wouldn't really work like that in the real world or the physical world.
And that's actually why I like working with Mark, because before we did this work together, before we even have taught classes together, I wouldn't have developed that lens, and that even if I don't know the answer, I know now to ask the question, is this accurate? How would this work? What are the liberties that are being taken here, and are they worth forgiving?
And you can explore some really interesting things by taking those liberties. I mean, that's the beauty of science fiction and fantasy, is that you can move something into a position where you can examine a question in a very different way, in a much more powerful way than you could if you stuck within the confines of reality.
And Valerie, are your students, do they take to this approach well? Do they appreciate having to look at even early reader books from this very critical point of view?
I think they do. We have a task that we assign Mark's plant biology students and my education students, whether it's children's literature or nonfiction, and we ask them to examine the books from their perspectives and then develop experiences for children. And children come on campus. And at first, my students are often, many of them are intimidated by the science, but they feel very comfortable with the literary elements, plot and setting and different structures of nonfiction. And we ask them to create something for the children that they couldn't create on their own. And we want them to prove it, that they're really using each other's lenses. And I think my students come away feeling empowered by looking at things with a different lens and knowing how to find out about it if they don't.
And your students, Mark, also appreciate having to look at literature?
Yeah, they do. And I think especially in plant biology, unless you're doing agriculture, I think very often they have a hard time figuring out what this means in their life, So I usually have students that are interested in food or maybe ecology. And then a lot of people who are just, I like plants, I think I'll take this course. And I try to ground it back into their, to their own experiences or to something that's real world, if you will.
Well, thank you both for sharing your knowledge with us and for telling us a little bit about Books in Bloom.
Thank you.
Thanks, Jane.
That's education professor Valerie Bong-Jensen and biology professor Mark Lubkowitz, both of St. Michael's College, talking about their collaboration, Books in Bloom, Discovering the Science in Great Children's Literature.